Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the third in a series of lectures organised by the International Relations Department on the subject of the transatlantic relationship after September 11. Crisis, what crisis? Over the this is the third and last of these lectures. Earlier this term we heard Guy Lunderstadt and François Heisbourg. And tonight, Professor Joseph Greco from Duke University will complete the series. Now, before introducing Joe Greco, I'd like to say one word of thanks to Professor Mick Cox, who has been the organizer of this incredibly successful series, which we all owe him a great debt. Normally, you thank the organizer at the end of the evening after everybody's left, but I thought on this occasion, Mick deserved to be thanked while there were actually people here. It's my great pleasure to introduce Joe Greco this evening. Joe is a professor of international relations, one of the strongest departments in the United States, in Duke. He spent most of his career there, though I noticed from the CV he's spent some time out in attractive locations in Italy as well, which is a good move. He's written two very influential books. I'll start that again. Two very influential books, Cooperation Among Nations, Independence and Autonomy. He's also very well known as an IR theorist. Those of you in the audience, I see a few who've actually taught IR theory or have studied it. You'll all know one article by Joe on the neorealist, neoliberal debate. It came out, I think, in international organizations about 10 years ago. It's been reprinted in 8 different collections now. If I had a hot lunch for every student who has summarized it and presented it as his own work in an essay, you know, I'd be even bigger than I am at the moment. So I'm not sure whether I should thank Joe for writing this essay or not, but it's certainly, I think, still the best single summary of what is at stake in the debate between neoliberals and neorealists. And Joe's talk this evening is entitled America Adrift, Myths and Realities About the United States in the New World Order. And without any more ado, I'd like to introduce him to give this lecture. Joe, thanks.
Well, please allow me to thank Chris Brown for his very kind and generous introduction. And please allow me also to join with him in thanking Mick Cox, Professor Cox, for inviting me here to London today and to have this opportunity to speak with you about the United States and American foreign policy and about America's place in the world. And I've had a lovely day here in London, and I know many of you, as in my own case, have come here to London from other parts of the world. We've all traveled here, and travel is a wonderful thing. It's a great way to learn about ourselves and about those we've left behind at home. And indeed, this is true not just of professors and students, it's true of presidents. Apparently, President Bush, as a result of his recent visit here, also had a useful learning experience. He was speaking to the Queen. And during that conversation, he asked her, what is her secret after so many years of her secret to her successful participation in British public life? And she said, well, one thing I always do is I make sure I have very smart people around her. And the president, curious about this, asked, how do you know that the people around you are extremely smart? And she said, allow me to demonstrate. So she picked up a special phone and dialed a secret code, and immediately Prime Minister Tony Blair answered the phone. And she said, Mr. Prime Minister, I have a question for you. Your mother has a child, your father has a child. The child is neither your brother nor your sister. Who is that child? He immediately said, ma'am, it's me. She said, thank you very much. And she said to the president, then you see what I mean. So the president was terribly impressed by this, so he went home. I hope not everyone has heard this joke already. But the president went home and he thought, maybe he should check on his own people. So he called Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. And he said, "Don, I have a question for you. Your mother has a child, your father has a child, the child is neither your brother nor your sister. Who is that child?" Silence. After a few moments, Secretary Rumsfeld said, "Mr. President, let me get back to you." So Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld then brought in his senior civilian advisors, all the presidential appointees, and said, "We got to come up with an answer. Who is this child?" They couldn't figure it out. So in desperation, Secretary Rumsfeld called Secretary of State Colin Powell. And he said, "Colin, your mother has a child, your father has a child, the child is neither your mother, your sister nor your brother. Who is the child?" And instantly, Secretary Powell said, "You dummy, it's me." I mean, hung up the phone. And then Rumsfeld called the president and said, "Mr. President, I have the answer. The child is Colin Powell." Well, immediately the president replied, "You dumbo, it's Tony Blair." Well, what else can be said about American leadership and its experiences abroad? Well, one of the things that is being said in a variety of American commentaries and British commentaries and European, as well as commentaries from around the world, is that the United States under the administration of George Bush has turned in a decided, fundamental direction away from the past 50 years of American multilateralism toward a separation from its traditional European allies through NATO, as well as the larger international community in respect to matters of war and peace, the UN Security Council. For example, just yesterday, in the Financial Times, Quinton Peel, a long-time close student of the United States, wrote about a Foreign Office strategy document, and he mentioned that it had many good elements, but one element was a failure to recognize that there is a problem for Britain in striking a balance between its relationship with the United States on the one hand and the European Union on the other. This is because, he said, there has been what he calls two fundamental changes in transatlantic relations since September 11th, 2001. He says, for the U.S., the shock of those terrorist attacks appears to have shifted the center of gravity away from any residual multilateralism and towards an absolute reliance on national power and resources. He then goes on to argue that while the U.S. has shifted away the center of American political life away from any what he calls residual multilateralism, he argues that the second big change is that the publics and governments of Western Europe have reacted to 9/11 with an ever stronger commitment to dealing with international institutions through international problems through international institutions. And he argues that the Foreign Office has failed to understand this, these two contradictory developments and responses to 9/11, and thus the strategy document is unsatisfactory. Well, my own view is that this analysis provided by Mr. Peel about the United States is incorrect. I would like to suggest that the current administration and future administrations can pursue, that the likelihood that such administrations can pursue a unilateralist military strategy is quite low. The level of unilateralism that we are likely to see from the Bush administration or future administrations is likely to be low. And there's a very simple reason for this. The reason is that the American public is strongly multilateralist, especially in matters of war and peace, and presidents do not stray for too long or to too high a level degree from U.S. public opinion. That is the main message that I would like to suggest this evening. I would also like to explore with you possible reasons why it is rational for members of the American public, average Americans such as myself, to have a preference that when the United States considers the matter of war and peace, that it do so in the framework of working with allies and through the United Nations Security Council. There's a very good understanding of some reasons why this would be rational, having to do with the sharing and mitigation of risks in dealing with a foreign foe. I would like to put forward a second reason why it may be rational for Americans to have a preference for multilateralism in matters of war and peace, namely what might be referred to as the capacity of these institutions and allies to serve and to perform a second opinion function. Imagine any of us, we go to our family doctor who says to us, I believe you need to have a pretty severe, serious, and risky surgical procedure today in order to put off an even worse problem tomorrow. I think for many of us, the immediate reaction, especially those of us who have reached a certain age, would be, I want a second opinion. Let's get a second opinion. My view is that for many Americans, the capacity of the president, when that president recommends a course of action in the international domain that may end in war, that they look to whether that president can get allies and international authorization for such use of force as a way of getting a second opinion on the wisdom and the intentions of that president. So for that reason, for as far as the eye can see, my guess is that Americans, members of the American public, will continue to have a strong preference for multilateralism, the attainment of allies, working through formal alliances whenever possible, and also going to the UN Security Council so that they can obtain a second opinion on their own president. To make this argument very briefly, I'll proceed in four steps. First, I'll ask you to accept the premise that there's good reason to believe that the Bush administration, or key members, not all members of the Bush administration, but the president, probably Vice President Cheney, probably Secretary Rumsfeld, probably a number of other key officials, have a unilateralist instinct that if they could, they would press the United States at the margins in a unilateralist direction. Second, though, I'd like to discuss more fully two other premises. First, that U.S. public opinion, that there's reason to believe that when the public does express a preference, that presidents seek to accommodate that preference. The second big premise that I'd like to discuss a little bit is that there are indeed big majorities of Americans who prefer a U.S. grand strategy that is grounded in multilateralism. Third, I'd like to offer two tests of this proposition, that Americans prefer multilateralism insofar as multilateralism provides opportunities for the attainment of second opinions on the wisdom and intentions of their president. I'll offer one test that is supportive of the proposition and one test that cuts against the proposition. In the paper that I've done connected to this topic, I report two other tests that I believe cut in favor of the proposition, but I'll offer for the purposes of economy of time only two brief results, one that cuts in favor, one cuts against, and I hope I'll persuade you that at least there's sufficient plausibility to the proposition that further research is warranted. And finally, I'll try to offer a few thoughts on policy implications. Well, can we say about the premise that if members of the majorities of the American public have a preference for multilateralism, that this serves as a constraint on presidential policymaking. And I'd like to offer 4 points in support of this premise. First, there is significant work by people like Robert Shapiro and Benjamin Page that indicates that members of the American public do express coherent, consistent preferences in public polling when it comes to foreign policy. If we didn't observe this, if members of the American public had were incoherent with respect to their views on foreign policy, then we would not be able to say that it serves as a constraint on presidential policymaking. But it's not. This is not a sufficient condition for the proposition, but it's a necessary condition. And indeed, the majority of work by people like Shapiro and Page, but also Ole Holstey, going against the original work by Gabriel Allman, indicates that the American public does express, the members of the public do have consistent, not always, they don't all agree with one another, but they do have the ability to express consistent, coherent opinions. Second, a necessary condition for this proposition is that the members of the U.S. electorate must vote on the basis of foreign affairs. It is often thought in the United States and abroad that Americans do not pay much attention to international affairs and do not vote on the basis of presidential performance in the foreign domain. However, some very significant work by specialists in American government and politics has indicated that, in fact, Americans do know what their politicians are saying and what their views are on foreign affairs and what they're doing in the international domain and vote on the basis of that. For example, my colleague John Aldrich, together with two other colleagues, found on the basis of a very systematic study, large-scale regression study of voter preferences in 1980 and 1984, the presidential elections in those 2 years, they found that, quote, in a reasonably fully specified model, foreign and defense issues appear to be very important influences on the choices voters make. Third, there is literature in the American government field, and I have to say I'm very happy I did this project so I could read a little bit of American government and actually understand some of it. There is literature that suggests that presidents are in fact concerned about and believe they must accommodate U.S. public opinion in the foreign domain. For example, there's interesting work by Larry Bartels on congressional voting on defense spending, and he finds a quite good positive correlation between votes cast by members of Congress on defense spending levels and public opinion at the constituent level on what the majority of constituents say ought to be the appropriate level of defense spending. Fourth, allow me to mention that the initial reporting on the particular case of the Iraq War indicates that even in the hard case of George Bush, potentially hard case of George Bush, there was an awareness on the part of the Bush administration of public opinion regarding going to the United Nations and that this influenced President Bush. In May of 2000 of this year, the Financial Times did a very large-scale sequence of reports, a series of reports on the Iraq War and U.S. decision-making, and it mentions that Bush had decided in September of 2002 that it was necessary to, quote, move on Iraq. He, however, also made the decision at that time to tackle Iraq through the UN. In the reporting indicates that in part this was due to deal with some, quote, well-known cracks in his administration. That's the Rumsfeld Colin Powell problem. But he said the reporting goes on to cite another reason, namely Bush, quote, was also responding to electoral pressures. Specifically, his political advisors were telling him that voters in the November midterm congressional elections were keen to see UN support for US policy. So this, of course, will be a matter for historians of the futures to tease out, investigate more fully. But the initial reporting suggests that even what might be a unilateralist president such as George Bush was aware of U.S. public opinion, wishing that the U.S. go through the UN in the Iraq matter, and there's evidence that the president sought to accommodate that preference. Finally, let me talk about the premise that large U.S., that Americans have a public preference for multilateralism, especially in war. Very briefly, for example, in June 2002, a strong majority of 65% said that the U.S. should only invade Iraq with UN's approval and support of its allies. Now, after the war, when individuals were asked the question, was it a good idea to go to the UN Security Council, this is the February-March effort, that did not work, was it a good idea to have tried for the Bush administration to have made the effort? 88% said it was a good idea that the Bush administration made that effort. In addition, more than two-thirds, when asked the question, should the United States, now that it has used force in Iraq without a second UN resolution, should U.S. leaders believe that feel freer to use force without UN Security Council authorization? More than two-thirds of the respondents said no. No precedent was set. U.S. presidents should not feel freer to use force without UN Security Council resolution. Finally, on the question of NATO, there's a lot of reporting and commentary that Americans have turned their back on NATO. The evidence is not consistent with this understanding. In June 2002, the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations did a poll of Americans as well as people in the U.S. government. They asked the members of the American public, as they had since 1974, what should be the character of the American commitment to NATO? Keep it the same, increase it, decrease it, withdraw altogether. In response to the question, what should be America's level of commitment to NATO? In June 2002, 65% of the respondents said that the U.S. commitment should stay the same. That was the highest percentage of respondents suggesting that the commitment should stay the same since the question was first asked in 1974. 11% of the respondents said that the U.S. commitment should be increased. That, too, was the highest percentage of respondents suggesting that the commitment should be increased since the question was asked in 1974. So in 2002, and in recent years, rather than experiencing a decline in interest and commitment on part of the public to NATO, there has been a net increase in American public opinion commitment to interest in NATO. Why? Why would Americans like NATO and wish that when a government is considering war and peace that it go to the UN Security Council and get allies? Well, there are well-known arguments, namely, if you have allies, you might be better able to coerce your adversary without the use of force, and also reduce the burden of using force and post-war reconstruction if you have allies. I would like to put forward a second idea, namely the second opinion function. And here, let's think back to this past summer and fall. How might an American respond to the arguments by Vice President Cheney, beginning in August, and then the President in September at the UN and elsewhere, when they argued that the United States might have to use force to disarm Saddam Hussein, to prevent Saddam Hussein from, in the future, having a large-scale weapons of mass destruction capability? Average Americans had a serious problem. They had neither the same information. They could not evaluate the information on the basis of which the administration made this argument, nor could they evaluate the processes used by the administration in reaching this determination. And ultimately, thirdly, they could not look into the hearts of these officials and understand their true motives and intents. This is a serious problem for anyone in a any citizen in a democratic society. In those circumstances, Americans might believe that the U.S. political system, with its checks and balances, might serve to reduce the probability of an extreme catastrophe. The necessity of the president to get either a formal declaration of war or at least some form of resolution. The competition among different executive departments. The work, presence and work of a robust, tough-minded media. All of these, the presence of these checks and balances might serve to alleviate concerns about the wisdom and intentions of the president and his top people. But Americans, I think, often also remember that sometimes the system doesn't work. Vietnam. All of those conditions were there. Divided government, competition among departments, a free, robust press, all of those elements of the American political system were present in the Vietnam era, but a terrible catastrophe occurred. In those circumstances, with that knowledge, for many Americans, I would suggest that to the degree that the U.S. president could obtain the support of key allies, especially if the president could do so through formal alliances and working through the UN Security Council, to the extent the president could do that, that would increase the confidence of such a, of the average American that the president was not leading the country down a dead end, a blind alley. Let me offer a couple of initial tests of this idea. As matters stand in existing public opinion polling data, we don't have questions and responses that ask Americans, basically, does having UN support mean that the president's not crazy? We don't have these good direct questions, and I hope that such questions will be put to Americans at some point. But it may be possible to look at existing public opinion polling data and ask, what would we expect to see in terms of U.S. public opinion if the proposition is plausible? What kinds of expectations ought we to see? What kind of trends, tendencies ought we to see that if we don't see those, what we expect to see, we would know the proposition is not worthy of further attention. If we do see results that are at least consistent with the proposition or not inconsistent with the proposition, it might be worthwhile doing further investing resources to do future work, further work. Let me offer one test or one expectation that cuts, is consistent, the results of which, of doing, looking at some of the data are consistent with the expectation, and then please allow me to report on the results of a test or expectations that cut against the proposition, the second opinion proposition. I'll begin first with the expectation, then I'll provide the rationale for the expectation, and then I'll report results, and finally draw an inference. Those are the four steps. Let's imagine that members of the public and members, high-level administration officials at any given time, agree that having allies and UN Security Council authorization is a good idea so as to allow the United States to deal more effectively with a foreign adversary, either through coercive diplomacy without the use of force or to be more successful at a lower cost if force is necessary. Let's imagine that members of the public and members of the top members of the administration agree on what might be called the external benefits, the benefits outside the United States of having allies and international support. But let's imagine that members of the public believe further that having allies and international support can serve as a check on members, on the proposals and ideas of the government. It's based that that having allies and international support serve as a reality check, serves as a reality check on leaders. We might then expect to see members of the U.S. public to be less inclined to use force in the midst of a crisis without allies than members of the government. Members of the government might say, we know what we're doing. We don't need to be checked upon. So if we have to use force in a crisis, we may not like it because we do know that there are some benefits of having allies and UN support, but we don't need it for this additional factor. So we would expect, therefore, I think it's fair to say, members of the public to be more reluctant to use force in the midst of a crisis than members of the administration, of a U.S. administration at any given time. Let me offer some results on this matter. In June 2002, in the survey that I mentioned that was completed by the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations with the in cooperation of the German Marshall Fund, I mentioned that this polling was regarding foreign affairs was done in respect to members of the U.S. public and also members of so-called U.S. leadership sample, presidents of corporations, unions, editorial writers, and a small subset of individuals in the government, which according to the Chicago Council, were at the assistant secretary level or its equivalent in the area of foreign affairs. Now in that case, in 1998 and in 2002, the same question was posed. We have small numbers of respondents. I mean, we have like 1,000 members of the U.S. public, but let me just give you the numbers. Assistant secretaries and other senior level staff, 25 individuals were questioned in, on a confidential basis in 1998, 34 in 2002. Now we can therefore compare the responses of this small sample of top level U.S. administration officials to members of the U.S. public, including, for example, on the question of using force in a crisis without international support either in form of any sort. And here's some figures in 2002. To the question, should the U.S. use force in a crisis, even without allies? 31% of the members of the U.S. general public said, yes, in a crisis, but even without allies, the U.S. should use force. 31%. Among the then the current Bush administration officials, the answer in the affirmative was 56%. Members of the Bush administration, by 25 percentage points, were more likely to support the use of force in a crisis without allies than members of the U.S. public. Even with a very small number in that U.S. government subsample, if one does a test of difference of proportions, taking into account the big differences in the sizes of the two samples, that is still a substantial difference in responding in the affirmative. Incidentally, this is not unique to the Bush administration. As I mentioned, the polling was also done in 1998. And please allow me just to report those results. In 1998, 23% of the American public respondents said, in a crisis, the United States should use force even if there are no allies. 50% of the Clinton administration officials at the assistant secretary level answered in the affirmative, yes, use force if in a crisis, even without allies. Again, that's a pretty substantial and significant difference. This would suggest that members, the inference I would draw from this, is that members of the U.S. public think they're getting something more from allies and international support than members, top-level U.S. officials. Now, what that extra is, this data does not speak to directly. However, it is at least consistent, I would suggest, with the proposition that members of the public believe that having those allies serves as a check on their the officials who themselves may feel less inclined to believe that they need a check. What's the result that cuts against the proposition? It's in the same poll. In 2002, June, members both of the public and of the U.S. administration subsample. We're asked the question, should the United States use force to remove Saddam Hussein from power? My expectation would be, if the second opinion thesis has merit, is that going from the general to the particular, we would expect that if Americans in general have a higher reluctance level to use force without allies than members of the government, then in a particular case, if we simply go give a specific country about which such force, for in connection to which force might be used, we should again see a higher reluctance on the part of the American public to use force in the case of Iraq without allies than members of the Bush administration. And let me report the results. Among administration respondents, 25% said the U.S. should use force even without allies. 20% of the general public said so. Yes, it's a somewhat higher tendency of members of the public to say use force even without allies to get rid of Saddam Hussein. However, that difference from a statistical viewpoint is not discernible from zero. So I think we have to say that test cuts against the second opinion thesis. Well, because I know we want to have a lot of time for discussion, please allow me to summarize and offer a couple of policy implications and as well some research implications. There are some issues regarding research. I also did tests on Democrats versus Republicans, people who approved of the president's general performance as opposed to those that did not, and I'd be happy to discuss those, the expectations and results in connection to those two tests if time permits and as interest prompts. Okay, research questions. We need to do work on the question of whether it's UN authorization or military allies that Americans focus their attention in seeking if they are seeking a second opinion. In much of the polling, for example, in the Chicago Council survey, as well as other surveys, the question is usually formed, should the U.S. use force without allies or UN Security Council authorization? And with that kind of question, it's difficult to know. Is it UN Security Council authorization that matters, or is it allies? Secondly, we need to devise tests more directly of the second opinion, questions that speak directly to the proposition of the second opinion. For example, ask samples of Americans, does having allies work reduce the risk that some empirical mistake has been made in interpreting intelligence that might come to the attention of the U.S. government? Third, we need to do research on whether Americans view coalitions of the willing as a good basis for a second opinion compared to formal alliance cooperation or U.N. Security Council authorization. Fourth, we have to ask Americans more clearly, are some allies a better source of a second opinion than others, if indeed they do see them as a source of second opinions? Policy implications. The key one that comes out, I believe, is that for as far as the eye can see, the United States is not going to turn its back on NATO or the UN Security Council. The second policy implication is that the strategy of coalitions of the willing may over time be self-defeating. Let me try to spin this out. If it is true that members of the American public believe that having allies and formal UN authorization provides a second opinion function, then it's quite possible that the publics of other countries, including other democratic countries, also believe that working through formal alliances and the UN Security Council, provides them information, provides them with a second opinion on the wisdom and intentions of their leaders. So if the United States, and will penalize leaders who don't get such authorization and work through formal alliance ties. So the U.S. may find, if it were to pursue a strategy of coalitions of the willing over a period of time, it may find itself with a smaller and smaller range of democratic allies to which it can appeal for assistance. My final, though, observation is that my suspicion is that this administration understands that. And the visit by Mr. Rumsfeld this week, Jude Dempsey mentions in some reporting in the Financial Times, the surprisingly accommodating attitude of Secretary Rumsfeld on the matter of a EU planning cell is indicative of a recognition by Mr. Rumsfeld that he can't push too hard in a direction away from NATO. And I was also struck by a comment, a part of President Bush's speech here in London, in which he said that international peace and security rests on three pillars. And the first pillar that he pointed to was working through effective international institutions. And so I get the sense that by virtue of the president's awareness of the preferences of the American public, that whatever his ideas might be, his preferences might be, his instincts might be, he recognizes that he cannot take U.S. foreign policy too far in a direction away from multilateralism, especially in the matter of war. Well, thank you very much for coming out this evening and for your kind entertainment of my ideas, and I look forward to your comments and your criticisms and your challenges. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Thanks very much, Joe. I think you have actually dispelled some of the myths and given us some reality. I find it very encouraging, actually, to know about the multilateralism of the American public, and it's good to have some empirical social science to back this up. Joe has very kindly agreed to take questions, and I think we've got half an hour or more for this. Back row. I'm now going to go and sit down and informally conduct this.
Thank you so much. My question is about, do you think that Al Jazeera television was able to access the American public opinion by providing different information while the war was going on? And do you think this is one of the reasons why the American administration was criticizing this television? Thank you.
Could you repeat the second part of your question, please?
Okay.
Is the mic on?
Okay. Yes. Do you think that this providing different information was one of the reasons why the American administration was criticizing the television? Thank you.
Yes. I don't know of specific studies on the range of sources on average that Americans exploit to obtain information on international affairs. My vague recollection is that a disturbingly high percentage do so through one of the three main nightly news shows, ABC, NBC, CBS. And my guess, the U.S. political science literature on this suggests that, in general, Americans are not, they are what sometimes they refer to as information misers. They don't spend, Americans on average, I don't know in terms of comparatively compared to publics in other countries, but it appears to be a relatively modest amount of time spent collecting news both on national and international affairs. However, they do look to cues of local leaders, friends, and so on. And I would also say I suspect that the low level of information gathering effort by members of the public actually feeds into the second opinion function. in a way, let's face it, if the U.S. president can say, for an average American, rather than trying to collect all the information one might collect in a crisis or a gathering crisis, such as we observed in Iraq, which is very time-consuming and difficult, for many Americans, it might be the view that, well, we got a UN, the president in November got a UN Security Council resolution. That must tell me something. That must tell me that there's a problem here. Or Tony Blair and other European leaders are supporting the president. They must have good information. So I may not know that information. I may not have the time to gather it. But it's good enough for me that these democratically elected leaders have agreed with the interpretation and assessment of the president. So in a sense, the information miser quality, let's face it, the high opportunity costs Americans believe they face for every minute they spend gathering information on foreign affairs may actually be one of a reason, as I'm thinking this through, why having allies and international support is so important.
Thanks very much.
I'll go quicker, more quickly, I promise, on my responses.
Mike is coming to you.
Hi, I study social policy here, and actually I don't want to, I'd like to just...
Where is the person?
Hello, up here. Hi, Professor
Joe
Krieko.
Yes.
Hi. Welcome to our great school. No,
thank you.
No, I'm...
Question?
I had the, I think, great honour of meeting a young American recently who spent 4 days, 4 days. He needed to be put up in London. I gave him a bed in my house. Anyway, and he spent 4 days lecturing me about what is really going on as far as he sees it. He wanted to stay in London so he could go on the Bush demo, demonstration, you know, protest, whatever. And one of the things that became very clear by day two was it seemed to him, and okay, let's put aside that he's a radical, he's an activist, he's totally anti his president for a moment, but it did seem fairly obvious that the media is controlled by corporate interests who are supporting the president. So I want a comment about that, that's one thing. Now, there are a whole list of accusations that one could throw at this man. I don't actually think insanity is one. I think projected insanity is one, so that we excuse him, his outrageously immoral behavior. But I am an AIDS widow at this school, and I think that one of the very many, if I may say, almost crimes that he has committed is to impose a morality on the rest of the world, which essentially promotes abstinence as the primary way of preventing a disease, which is essentially social, and people are not in a position to prevent when they are completely living in poverty, and when their priorities are, you know, hunger and eating. So if you could address at least one of those things about the corporate investment and the media, I'd be really grateful. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Yes. Your view is shared by many, many Americans.
I know.
Although it's unfortunate that this person apparently needs lessons in listening and conversational skills, if the impression was left that he talked for 4 days in a row. But the broader point is this. I think individuals in general are properly skeptical of their leaders, whether they live in democratic countries or non-democratic countries, whether they are Americans, French, British, Germans, Israelis. And it's precisely because there were such concerns raised about the U.S. administration, its motivation, its linkages with the international or the U.S. oil industry. There were charges made that the Bush administration had been captured by Jews. There were charges that were who wanted Iraq to be destroyed in order to defend Israel. There were charges made that it was really all about Halliburton oil. There were charges made that Bush wanted to go to war to avenge his father, the attempted assassination of his father. There were charges and arguments made by very serious people that George Michael Lind, for example, writing in the Washington Monthly, that Bush wanted to go to war with Iraq because he's a fundamentalist Southern Christian and is basically stupid or crazy. All of this was part of the American conversation. If one could imagine, nothing was said outside of the U.S. against the war that was not said also many times over inside the United States. And in that context, average Americans such as myself were torn about what to do. And in that context, in precisely that context, the question of whether there was international support became all the more pertinent. So in a sense, one of the reasons why I think Americans want to be multilateralist is that they have all these concerns and doubts about their leaders, and therefore look to the outside as a second opinion, a source of a second opinion.
Can you ask the question about the corporate ownership of media? I think that's
there's about 30 people waiting to ask a question here, so I think we'll just have to let Joe answer them in his own way. Matthias.
Thank you very much for your reassuring lecture, and especially the fact that you think that foreign policy, American foreign policy, will not be going too far away from the opinion of public opinion in America. But I would be even more reassured if I could know how far is too far. Mm-hmm. I mean, does your theory allow us some kind of prediction of the degree of freedom the American administration had? Because if you had given this lecture exactly 1 year ago, I have had the opinion that actually the war in Iraq would not have happened, which actually it happened. So I would be interested in knowing a little bit more if, exactly on the degree of freedom,
yes.
And if you could make some more specific prediction. For instance, would you say that if Tony Blair had not supported Bush, then the foreign policy of Bush would have been different, would have been this enough to make the difference in the degree of freedom of the Bush administration? Thank you.
Yes, thank you. I've struggled with that question, and I think it's a central question. My guess at this point is that the degree of freedom is somewhere between good faith effort and success in obtaining formal alliance support by the president for the use of force and UN Security Council authorization. In other words, had the president not gone to the UN in September and not made the effort to get 1441, I don't know if it would have made the difference. But there would have been significant public opinion. There was always a majority that wanted to use force. It was in the 50% if posed the question, should we get rid of Saddam? It was always, since 1998, polling suggests above 50%. But the use of force was always conditioned on international support. Now, what did that mean? I think it meant making a good faith effort to get international support. And I do think that not all allies, as it turns out, were equal. And I think it really did, there was something about, why would we say Great Britain, for example, versus Spain? Spain made it clear, the Spanish leader, Mr. Aznar, made it clear he supported the U.S., but he wouldn't use force. Blair worked in a history, even in respect to Iraq, of a British willingness to use force and to take casualties. That accorded Blair tremendous, I think, credibility. So his opposition, I think, would have had a material impact on public opinion polling, which then, given the difficulties after the war, I think would have led to greater public dissatisfaction and greater opportunities for the Democrats to slam George Bush. So I think the issue is, what the American public may not necessarily wish is the having
let's say, that second Security Council resolution, but the president had to be seen to have made a good faith effort to get it.
Okay, yeah.
Three quick points, Professor Greco. You suggested in your remarks that the American people look to international bodies like the UN.
Could you speak up a bit, please?
That the American public look to bodies like the UN and NATO to provide a second opinion to help them assess the reasonableness of their government's view. How fitted are these bodies to play that role, given that the US government has a very powerful influence in how they reach their decisions? Second, second point. You said Americans sympathize with multilateral institutions, but is it not the case that in any specific emergency they will automatically support the US government? You can deal with those points.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, very good. I think there is some evidence of what might be called a rally around the flag effect, that the president in an immediate crisis, especially if there's some spectacular event such as 9/11, has tremendous freedom of action. But when there is a decision that can be made over, to the extent that time, that there is time to make a decision, and especially to the degree to which the use of force is elective rather than imposed, then I think the president has less and less freedom of action. And certainly Iraq is a case in which this was an elective surgery, not emergency surgery. Second, how fitted is the UN Security Council and NATO to play a second opinion function? I think the UN Security Council, because of American influence, I agree with you, to some degree the behavior of these institutions is endogenous to American preferences. However, I think in recent years we've learned that both NATO and the UN Security Council have demonstrated that they are not necessarily going to follow the lead of the United States. This is in January, February, for example, this year, with regard to both the NATO question regarding support of Turkey and the idea of having one last Security Council resolution. In both cases, the institution did not follow the preferences of the U.S., in which case, in a sense, what you could say is that in the future, both institutions will have even more credibility as a source of second opinions, insofar as credibility is affected by the degree of independence of the United States.
Okay. You were in earlier, yeah? Sorry.
Thank you very much. I was wondering whether the renewed multilateralism of President Bush has not more to do with the difficulties in Iraq and the dependency on NATO allies eventually and the United Nations to come to the help of the United States than with American public opinion. Because I assume even before he went to war against Iraq, American public opinion was equally multilateral than they are at the moment. And perhaps a second point, I recently talked to Donald Rumsfeld in the Pentagon, and we had a very long chat, and he was very positive about the allies, about the European allies. He was very positive about the Germans, less positive about the French, but on the whole, he came across as a multilateralist. But my interpretation would be what is going on is really wedge driving. Get the Germans on the side, forget about the French, because they are kind of difficult and have that kind of hang up about their own superpower status. So what is going on is that the United States, at least the Pentagon, is trying to drive a wedge between the European allies so that some will be drawn on board and some others can be forgotten about. And I was wondering what you might think about that.
Thank you. I agree with your intervention that the recent U.S. interest in NATO and the Security Council is motivated by the more traditional, is especially, it can readily be linked to the traditional idea of burden sharing. So I agree with you entirely on that matter, and I think that's what the American public is focusing on after the war, that there be burden sharing. And that is definitely acting as a constraint on the president. I would, but in future crisis, that can be true, and it can also be true that in the future, especially, for example, if there are other instances in which the preventative use of force, it's not preemptive, that's a misnomer, the preventative use of force by the United States, it could also be true that in such future circumstances, the interest on the part of the Americans in risk sharing, coercive diplomacy, and second opinion function may be operative. On the divide and rule question, I think I was thinking about this today. Europe has had a very tough year. The European Union has had a very hard year. Let's face it, the Growth and Stability Pact was killed by France and Germany, with all the ironies associated with that. And also great differences have emerged between current big members, Germany in particular, and Poland, regarding who's going to have the biggest say in the European Union. All this stuff about all being part of a community is being somewhat, shall we say, is being challenged by the state-centered behavior of the members. And thirdly, I think that the controversy surrounding the Iraq war with the Group of Seven letter, Group of Ten letter, and then some of the behavior of Jacques Chirac and some of his comments to the new entrants to the European Union have not been favorable and have not been helpful to the cause of European integration. And I'm not sure that some members of the U.S. administration cry at night when they see these developments. I don't think they do. But it's interesting that this week, Mr. Rumsfeld recognized that he could not see the idea of a planning cell, because this was something that the European countries wished to pursue, and in particular that Prime Minister Blair wanted to pursue. There's a remarkable story in the Sunday Telegraph. Apparently, the George Michael Howard and Mr. Ankrum, the shadow foreign secretary, when they met with President Bush, said, "Be opposed. Don't accept this planning cell by the European Union, because it will hurt the NATO relationship." And the president apparently said to them both, "Tony Blair tells me that it will not do this. I trust Tony Blair. I'm not listening to you." He stiffed the leader of the opposition and the shadow secretary. Basically said, leave. So I think what that indicates is that the U.S. administration has limits on the degree to which divide and rule is of interest to it.
I'm going to take in two at a time from now, because
yes,
we've got so many people here. From the same part of the room, though, so it makes it easier. Front row and then the green bully. Green rugby shirt.
Welcome to London and welcome to LSE. Huh?
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Very welcome to LSE at this Christmas time. But I want to ask a question. You know, low international relation practitioner know the future exactly, am I right? No one can predict the future exactly. And for the new international order, we don't know what happened 100 years later, we don't know. But for this 5 or 6 years, do you think America will have a unipolar position? Because after the Cold War, we have no bipolar now. Maybe America will have unipolar position. There's only one American power, and then some European and other power just become a partner together. And also, you can see the reality in the Iraqi crisis. America make the major decision. They don't respect the UN Security Council. They still occupy the Iraq, a sovereign state, and then they don't want to go. They are against the international law. But also for American opinion, yeah, we respect the opinion. We know American did opinion pool very much. But the American big country, they only did 1% people. Nobody, political opinion poll can add more than 1% of people. So 1% cannot represent 100%, so this is not a good indicator. Normally, American foreign policy is different from American people. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And the green rugby shirt.
Yes, thank you. It seems to me that your central argument is that U.S. administrations will act multilaterally because the U.S. public shows a preference for a multilateral action over unilateral action. However, it seems to me that there are also other preferences on U.S. administrations which would show a preference for unilateral action. For example, that it's easier because you don't have to reach consensus with difficult allies, France, Germany, or whatever. And it also seems to me that in recent events, the Bush administration hasn't shown a very strong preference for multilateralism, in which case my question to you would be, how do you account for this other preference to act unilaterally, as opposed to your theory that public opinion will prefer multilateralism? And do you think that this is something particular to the Bush administration, or do you think there's something that can be said about American policy more generally?
Thanks.
Thank you. yes, I think for a president, for an administration, there are many pressures, many calculations. We could think of a kind of a vector with many, many different sources of calculations, or think of a simultaneous equation with many elements, and the president has to optimize. I do recall in the Bush administration this discussion of the argument was that Kosovo showed that working through NATO was very difficult and that they would not make that same mistake as had the Clinton administration, which acted without a UN Security Council resolution, but which did act through NATO. And that, what your question really speaks to is the question of what's the preference function or preference ordering of national leaders. And at the core of my argument is that there may be many different elements of what might be called the objective function or the preference ordering of leaders, but my guess is that I agree with my colleagues in the American government literature, beginning with David Mayhew, that number one, actually number two, maybe number five, down to number 10 is, I want to get reelected. U.S. politicians want to get reelected, and if they're in their second term as president, they want to go down in history as a terrific person and help their party. So what then operates as a constraint, I think, on unilateralism, with all its apparent advantages, is this other constraint, and I believe there's a pretty high weight. On to the other question. I agree with you, polling is difficult. I never did work on polling until I did this paper. I hardly ever read a poll until I did this paper. But I've had to read a little bit about the polling literature. And yes, it's very difficult for a large country like the U.S. the way questions are asked especially, to be utterly confident about the results of any given poll. Funny thing about the multilateralism thing is that no matter what the poll, no matter what the source, no matter when it was taken, you get multilateralist responses on the part of these samples of Americans. I would recommend that you're on this matter taking a look at the Program on International Policy Attitudes website, PIPA. And it has these large reports on U.S. attitudes on foreign relations. And I was struck when I looked at this literature at the outset. I mean, I've worked on realism. One of the big things I've learned as a theorist is, guess what? Leaders don't just respond to external circumstances. They respond to domestic. I've done domestic structuralism also, but I was shocked at the level to which they respond to U.S. public opinion. And that public opinion is amazingly consistent. Finally, the other point, unipolarity. I know a lot of my friends in a variety of schools of thought, including the realism camp, like to say that we are living in a unipolar world. I don't think so. My view is that in 1969, when Soviet and Chinese forces clashed on the Ussuri River, that was the end of bipolarity and the beginning of multipolarity. And by my sense of what constitutes polarity, we're living at least in a tripolar world, if not a multipolar world. As I mentioned at the expense of some colleagues who heard this earlier, if we think of polarity as the number of states that cannot defeat each other in a war, if you're a pole because you cannot be defeated by other great powers, I don't think we're in a unipolar world. I'll put it this way. Does anybody think that the United States of America could defeat China and occupy it? That's crazy. Does anybody think the United States could defeat and occupy Russia? I don't think so. I'm not sure the United States could defeat Brazil in that sense. And in that sense, I question this idea of unipolarity.
Okay, I've got to do a cluster now,
yes.
And then I think we'll let Joe off. I've got... I'll take one cluster in the front here,
yeah,
and then one at the back there. Lady in front, and then gentleman two behind.
You sort of just touched on what I was going to ask you, but I was interested in kind of empirical evidence, polls, etc., about when the public in the US are canvassed about NATO and UN, etc., how educated they actually are about those organizations and the significance of them, and maybe a percentage like 65% in favor of the status quo, and that being the highest ever, is because they haven't got a huge idea about what they do, and therefore maintaining the status quo is fantastic. And another thing you slightly touched on, but I was just wondering, is there any evidence to support where in the electoral process a president is most comfortable acting, well, either going to war or acting unilaterally and going to war? Is there anything to support that? Because I tend to think that Bush, March 2003, was probably the latest he could go to war, given how risky it was, given that there is an election in a year time.
Yeah. Thanks. Rasmus, two back. Yeah, and then you.
To what extent can your very reasonable arguments be applied to other issues than the pure security policy of war and peace? Can you also provide us with encouraging predictions about the future of, let's say, the International Criminal Court or the Kyoto Protocol?
Very good. Lady in the middle. And then we'll put Joe on.
You've stressed, it's your main argument, really, that the American public would rather there were unilateralism, and especially because, you say, it would give them, if you like, a second opinion on the decisions of their president. If you think, or if I think anyway, about the sort of things that happen when UN resolutions have been obtained, I can't help feeling having a rather more cynical view on it and thinking, well, it's arm twisting in the extreme when it happens, and maybe the US government is simply doing a bit better on putting in place possible threats and bribes for next time, rather than the US asking the rest of the world, what do they think, and do you agree with us? I mean, you know, do you have a comment?
Thanks.
Well, on the question of whether it's just easy to, it's convenient for, I think I agree with you that if posed with those four questions in June 2002, keep U.S. commitment the same to NATO, increase it, decrease it, withdraw entirely, there would be perhaps an inclination. I think most people would say, well, what has worked in the past probably is working now in the future. What I'm getting at is, what is it that Americans might be thinking about works that produces that 65% figure? It is. I did a test whether that 65% is—it's not just above the average, but it's bigger than what you would expect by chance. So I thought that was kind of interesting in June 2002 on electoral cycles and war. There is an interesting literature that suggests that presidents are extremely reluctant to. Kurt Galbatz has suggested that presidents are very reluctant to use force. Democratic leaders are reluctant to use force close to elections. Foreseeable elections. On the issue of ICC and Kyoto, it is interesting that the public opinion polling, and this I would suggest looking at Pew Center data on this, there's remarkably high U.S. support for these international initiatives, for example, in respect to ICC and Kyoto, even if it would be difficult for the U.S. government. And it is it is the case that the administration, both the Clinton administration and the Bush administration, have opted not to pursue either. So it could be that there's something about that the public may give discretion to the president by issue area in respect to interest in multilateralism. And it could be that the more we get to issues of war and peace, to the extent that costs are high, interest in having a second opinion goes up, which would perhaps account for the difference between war and peace issues versus non-war and peace issues. On whether your interesting point about the partners, are the partners independent actors? And in particular, for example, is Britain an independent actor in its relations with the United States? And my own sense is that if we look at things like the ICC or Kyoto, Britain has shown, and Tony Blair in fact has shown, that he will stiff the Americans. He would have stiffed the Americans on the planning cell. If Bush said, "I don't want you to do it," I think Blair would have said, "I'm going to do it, sorry." And in part, that's one of the reasons why I think, beyond trust, I think there's a cold-blooded decision to accept the planning cell. But we should remember, for example, a lot of Americans remember what happened in 81, 82, when the then Reagan administration tried to impose controls on, tried to stop the Soviet West European oil pipeline. And the British government said at that time, if any U.S. firm does not comply with its contractual obligations regarding this oil pipeline, we will bring criminal charges against the executives in Britain. So Americans, I think, understand that both the present and past, if interests diverge, they're dealing with independent states.
Thanks. Red sweater down there and white sweater behind. It's a rather tasteless way of referring to people. I do apologize.
Yeah, thank you. I'm the red sweater.
Okay, I'll write that down. Red sweater. Thank you.
If you could maybe just shortly come back to the role of Britain in this game, and maybe also think about that from the other way around, although that was not really the content of your talk. What do you think, from the American perspective, persuaded Britain to stand close to the Americans, in contrast to the other Europeans?
Thank you.
White sweater. And then one up in the balcony.
Thank you. I get the feeling that overall the lecture is less about global politics and more about your fundamental belief in the nature of democracy and how it works. Because you have two fundamental assumptions. One, that the American government is responsive to the preferences of the public opinion. Second, that this public opinion is well informed, as it should be in a democracy. And third, that the U.S. administration will pay the price should it not respect the demands from the public opinion. But from your examples, these three fundamental beliefs are contradicted, because I will give only one of them, although I have three. The first one is that the American public opinion wants the administration to go to the UN. Well, the U.S. administration can go and did go to the UN, knowing full well that, one, the UN will not accept its demands, and two, that it will go ahead with its plans for international action no matter what the UN says. And third, the administration will pay no price for this. So how confident are you that these rules of democracy are actually in place?
Thanks. Thank you. One up in the balcony.
Yeah. Hi, my question is not about the Persian Gulf. It's another region in the world, but I think it's quite relevant to a discussion on U.S. foreign policy, the U.S. military, and their relationship with intergovernmental organizations into the 21st century. My question is about a relatively new case. It's only been receiving publicity within the past month, so you might not yet be familiar with it. There's a Inuit community in Greenland that's going to the High Court in Copenhagen trying to get the U.S. military base that was established in the 1950s out of Greenland because it's on their native property, and I'm curious as to your opinion as to where this is likely to head.
I think that'll do. Yeah. Okay, thanks. No more questions. I think we pushed Joe too far, but
thank you.
Use this as a summary.
Yes, thank you. first, let me again thank Chris Brown and Mick Cox for allowing me to come visit and to participate and to receive these good questions. Second, I do not know about this emerging issue, so I cannot speak. I would not dare say something. I mean, professors sometimes don't follow this rule, but I try not to talk about things I know nothing about. On the issue of the public, I agree with two of the three premises. I don't know if we need the premise of, going back to the earlier question, of a highly informed U.S. public for the second opinion function to be in operation, but the first and the third are necessary conditions. I wonder if we could think about a counterfactual. Let's imagine the president doesn't think that thinks that there is no second opinion function operating on the part of the American public. We would then have, I think, a challenge. We would have the challenge of understanding not just why the Bush administration went to the UN in September and then in November, but then in January and February. That to me is an interesting part of it, is that Tony Blair felt that he had to make a good faith effort, but that just illustrates the point that the U.S. president knows that the U.S. public wants allies such as Britain, and if one of the allies says, we need to go back to the UN, the president, however reluctant, has to try to accommodate that preference. Regarding why Blair and Great Britain took a view different, for example, from that of France or Germany, it's very interesting. I don't think that it was merely in response to the request of the Bush administration, because Blair had been saying as early as 1999 that either something Saddam had to, that the Saddam Hussein problem was not something that could be left alone for the foreseeable future. So in a sense, Blair was hawkish on Iraq before the Bush administration even came into office. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Joe. You've all clapped before you were told to, which was rather impressive. It shows it was a spontaneous gesture. I'd like to thank Joe very much for a good talk, but also for the meticulous way in which he's answered our questions. I'd like to thank Mick again, and also Margot Lai, to the head of the department, for the support for this great series. Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you.